Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Obama's renewed focus on Wall Street reform following a White House meeting on Monday with the nation's top financial regulators. Dennis Kelleher, the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in U.S. and global financial markets, joins us to discuss why regulators have missed 60% of the rulemaking deadlines as the Dodd-Frank bill, which has been under relentless attack from Wall Street, tries to implement rules to prevent another crash. Then we'll examine how the massacre in Egypt could have been avoided and why it was not, with two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Rode, a columnist for Reuters who was kidnapped and held captive by the Taliban, which he wrote about in a memoir, A Rope and a Prayer. He joins us to discuss his latest article at Reuters, A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre, and the growing alienation amongst the young, who are the majority in the Middle East, towards the United States, which he argues is more hated and less secure across the region. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, a senior fellow at the National Security Archive, who obtained a 322-page declassified history of the CIA's super-secret Area 51 under the Freedom of Information Act. We will discuss what has been revealed about decades of secret activity at a site many believe houses the remains of aliens and an extraterrestrial spacecraft, and how the CIA's turf battles with the Air Force over control of spy platforms has led to the cancellation of successful programs. And joining us now is Dennis Kelleher, who is the president and chief executive officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog and has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street. Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as the chief counsel and senior leadership advisor to the chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Kelleher.
Hi, Ian. Nice to be with you.
And on Monday, the president hosted all the top financial regulators at the White House, where apparently he gave them a kind of pep talk. And I take it that one of the things that perhaps was on the agenda is that regulators have missed 60% of the rulemaking deadlines under the Dodd-Frank bill, which, of course, has been under relentless attack from Wall Street. So I understand what Wall Street's up to and how and why the Republicans have been trying to kill it. But why have those that have been trying to implement it, why the slow marching?
Well, I think there's been two primary reasons for the delay in implementing all of the financial reform law. And you hear these numbers all the time of 60% of the rules haven't been done, or this percent or that percent. Interestingly, those reports, quote unquote, are always put out by big law firms who are trying to gin up business from the big banks. So it's a little bit self-serving. Secondly, they also never mention that the delay is almost entirely due to the Wall Street war on financial reform. I mean, they never mentioned that Wall Street's using its unlimited resources to purchase basically every lawyer, lobbyist, PR spinner, politician, academic, trade group, and you name it, to overwhelm the agencies with comments and meetings, which the agencies are required to consider under the Administrative Procedures Act. So that has tremendously slowed down this entire process. And if that's not despicable enough, given that financial reform is supposed to protect Main Street from Wall Street, and Wall Street is fighting to prevent that reform being put in place, if that isn't despicable enough, at the same time, what Wall Street and its allies are doing are preventing the agencies from being funded at anywhere near the level that they need to have the personnel and technology to implement the rules in financial reform. So when you put those two things together, it's a double whammy on the agencies to try and get the job done. Frankly, it's a miracle that some of the agencies have got as much done as they have with as few staff and funding as they've been given.
So obviously memories are very short on Wall Street, because it was only in 2008, not very long ago, that the entire economy almost crashed. And what ensued was the biggest transfer of private debt into public debt in the history of the world. And so, in other words, Main Street bore the brunt and Wall Street was made whole. And now they're going back to their old habits. So I don't understand why it is that, one, they have no historical memory, and two, what is it about deregulation that they're so insistent on when the results of deregulation result in the whole house coming down or almost coming down?
Well, it's a good question, Ian, and the operative word is almost. The problem is that Wall Street made literally hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in bonuses in the run-up in the years before the crash of 08. All of that was really only possible because of deregulation and then a complete and gross lack of law enforcement on Wall Street, which then went on a crime spree. But they padded their pockets, they got their limos, their planes, and their mansions throughout the country and throughout the globe. And then, it's true, it crashed the global financial system, but they didn't pay the price. They had the party, and the American people got stuck with the bill. So it's not that they have amnesia or that they have some remorse over crashing the financial system. The years before the crisis were darn good for them, and regrettably, the years since the crisis have been darn good for them because the American people picked up the bill. And in fact, Better Markets did a study that showed that the financial crash is going to cost the United States more than $12.8 trillion. So every person in the U.S. not getting a paycheck from Wall Street is going to be paying to clean up the mess Wall Street created for decades. And here we are just a few years later, and they're making record profits again. So, you know, it's not amnesia. It's a conscious policy of Wall Street and its trade groups, including those who are commenting every day and quoted in the paper about how bad financial reform is for America, when what they really mean is that financial reform, which would protect Main Street, is bad for Wall Street's bonuses and profits. And that is good for Main Street, because we need to limit the reckless gambling on Wall Street that crashed the House of Cards and stuck this country with a phenomenally large, almost unimaginably large bill.
And again, I'm speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. So the cost that you just mentioned to the economy from the crash is equal to one entire year's GDP of the United States.
Right. That's why I say it's almost unimaginable.
Right.
And the other thing, Ian, that we hear all the time, people talking about the Fed policy and about having to fight deficits, the remarkable thing is nobody ever talks about where these things come from. But we have huge deficits that we need to bring down. Much of them are due to Wall Street crashing the global financial system, because when it threw everybody out of work and caused so many businesses to fail, tax revenues plummeted, but social needs skyrocketed. And the difference between those two largely account for much of the deficits in Obama's first term. And yet now we hear about the need, we have to have austerity and fight the deficits. Nobody ever mentions, well, wait a minute, we have those because of the Wall Street collapse. The same thing with Fed policy. The Federal Reserve Board has undertaken extraordinary efforts to try and help the economy heal from the Wall Street crash. So we have what are called zero interest rates, and we have this bond buying program, $85 billion a month, where the Fed has a balance sheet of $3 trillion now. It's at historic levels. And people talk about, oh, we have to change that and we have to change this. But nobody ever says, well, wait a minute, why are these actions necessary? And it's because of the ongoing economic wreckage from the financial crash, which was the worst since 1929, caused by Wall Street, which is why we so desperately need to get sensible financial reform into place, so that not only the crime spree on Wall Street can be limited, but that their reckless gambling with often borrowed billions to pad bonuses and do nothing for the economy.
Well, when you mentioned, though, that the deficit went up at the same time as the financial costs for those affected by it, the unemployment and the wreckage and the homelessness, et cetera, that was caused, that is, I think, just a window into the social cost And that hasn't that led to the further polarization in this country between the rich and the poor?
Well, it certainly has. And in fact, you know, we, as I say, Better Markets did a study, and it's actually available on our homepage on our website, which is www.bettermarkets.com. But if you go there, it really details not just the economic cost inflicted on this country, but it puts a face on the real human cost of unemployment, skyrocketing food stamp use, free school lunch use, homelessness, eviction, all the multitude of problems is almost unimaginable. And it has been, and many of those things are still going on. And one of the things that I wanted to mention, because what the industry says is we don't put too many financial rules in place on us, or it will hurt economic growth. It will hurt credit. We won't be able to lend to Main Street if you put too many financial regulations on us. Well, first of all, there's no cost from financial regulation on Wall Street that will come anywhere near close to the cost of an unregulated Wall Street crashing the global financial system. But the second thing is, today, there was just a study a few days ago that showed the big three banks today have an excess of $860 billion in deposits. So that's the amount of deposits that they retain over the amount of loans that they're giving. Well, today that means that just the three big banks could actually lend $860 billion more, funded just by their deposits. They're not lending for a whole variety of reasons, but the claim that they're not lending because of financial reform is nothing but a fraud. It's a lie meant to deceive the American people and to intimidate politicians and regulators from putting in place the overdue necessary financial reform rules, which are pretty minimal, actually, but they are going to be sufficient if they're done right to protect Main Street from Wall Street.
So the president on Monday gave the financial regulators a pep talk, and as we've discussed earlier in this interview, Dennis Kelleher, Wall Street's been at war with financial regulation since it began. The Republicans are completely in their pocket, and a lot of Democrats are. It seems to be that they're fighting over who can get on the House Banking Committee, because that guarantees you enormous amounts of money from the banks, so you don't have to do as much fundraising. That is, unfortunately, the cynical truth. So there aren't many advocates left out there for the citizen and for the consumer. You've got these people that we should be grateful for, like Senator Elizabeth Warren, whose brainchild has been under a constant assault, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And the president had to resort, or the Senate had to resort to threats of ending the filibuster in order to get Richard Cordray in there. So we've seen all of these fights, and that all of it adds up to the fact that Wall Street's got the money to hire its political hirelings to do its bidding. But is the lesson that you're telling us about the cost of what happened in 2008 and how the public made these people whole, and how it's not that they have no historical memory, it's just that they got off scot-free, so why do they care? Does that mean that some of them should have gone to jail, and some of these big banks should have gone under?
Well, there are two very important questions that are quite distinct. Whether or not the big banks should have gone under is a different question. And, you know, when and I was in a senior government position in the fall of 08 and the spring of 09 at the height of the crisis. And frankly, I think the only case that can be made is that it would be grossly irresponsible for anybody to essentially gamble over whether or not the country would have to suffer a second Great Depression. And that's what government officials and policymakers were facing. And that's why you had both a Republican administration, and not just the President Bush, but his Secretary of Treasury Paulson, but then a Democratic administration and their personnel, prevent the collapse of the financial system, which is what you're really talking about when you say let a few more banks fail. And so things are bad, and the costs are astronomical, but they could have been, a second Great Depression would have been magnitudes greater than what they were. So I don't think the choice would be to let banks fail. The real choice was whether or not the bailouts should have been done with absolutely no accountability and absolutely no conditions and requirements. And that was the fatal flaw in the bailouts. It wasn't that they were done, it was the terms they were done under, which history is going to look back and I have no doubt condemn. Now, secondly, whether or not, and you're right on the money here, Ian, whether people should have gone to jail, people should still go to jail. When anybody looks reasonably at what happened in these on Wall Street during the run-up to the crisis, you're talking about the creation, packaging, distribution, and sale of what became trillions of dollars of worthless securities, which had AAA ratings, which means they were supposed to be as safe as the dollar bill. And they were sold and packaged throughout this entire globe. It cannot be the case that a crime was not committed when trillions of dollars of worthless securities are sold as being worth trillions of dollars. And it's not just a headline. We also know from the details. If you look at the Abacus case, which was the Goldman Sachs case, the permanent subcommittee on investigation in the SEC in the Senate did an extensive analysis of what really happened there. And apparently only the U.S. Department of Justice can't find a law that is broken there. But anybody, I mean, I think a first-year associate at a law firm would get fired if he couldn't figure out innumerable laws that were violated both on the criminal side and the civil side. But what we've had, and what we've seen, regrettably, is the Department of Justice and the SEC have turned a blind eye to a lawlessness on Wall Street, which has not only rewarded but incentivized crime.
Well, Dennis Kelleher, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Dennis Kelleher, who is the President and Chief Executive Officer of Better Markets, Inc., a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that promotes the public interest in the U.S. and global financial markets. Better Markets is a Wall Street watchdog that has been referred to as a persistent thorn in the side of Wall Street, and Dennis has held several senior staff positions in the United States Senate, most recently as Chief Counsel and Senior Leadership Advisor to the Chairman of the Senate Democratic Policy Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about Egypt's avoidable massacre.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Rode, a columnist for Reuters, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a former reporter for The New York Times. He won his first Pulitzer for a series in the Christian Science Monitor that helped uncover the Srebrenica massacre in Bosnia, which formed the basis of his book Endgame, The Betrayal and Fall of Srebrenica. And he won his second Pulitzer in 2009 as part of the New York Times team covering Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's the co-author of A Rope and a Prayer, which is about his experience having been kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And his latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. And his latest article at Reuters is A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Rode.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And why do you say that the massacre was avoidable? I mean, I did talk to some of the people that were involved in the original revolution on the secular liberal side, and they made the case. This fellow Jawad Nabulsi, who's blind in one eye, he was shot during the first revolution. He said he would go to the Muslim Brotherhood encampments every day and talk to people that he knew, and then he saw them later at the beach on the weekend, and he knew that the whole thing was petering out. So that's one explanation I've had, but what's your explanation?
I'm just referring to there were first stories in Reuters and the New York Times that there was an agreement, an initial agreement that the Brotherhood had agreed to that involved the release of two lower-level Brotherhood officials. And then in exchange, the Brotherhood would sort of shrink the size of the protest. There were steps that had been set up when Bill Burns was there, you know, the Undersecretary of State, and EU representatives and others. And it was the army that sort of rejected that U.S. and European-backed plan to defuse tensions.
So would this be payback? I mean, we know that the police hated the Muslim Brotherhood, and they basically didn't do any work until this recent coup that they don't want to refer to as a coup. And they suddenly, they showed up on the street the next day, and gasoline appeared in the, at the gas stations, etc. So how much of this is just a lust for vengeance on the part of the military and the police who apparently hate the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, to be fair, you know, it's fear. I mean, what you'll hear from the police and the army and secular Egyptians is that we're being naive, that the situation in Cairo today is akin to Tehran, you know, just after the revolution with Khomeini in the 70s, and that, you know, the Brotherhood wasn't going to hold further elections. Morsi was gradually consolidating power, and so you had to have this move. It's this fear among secular Egyptians that this was, you know, the Brotherhood is radical. They are armed, and they do want to create, you know, an Islamic state. You know, maybe that's true, but and there's no question Morsi did a terrible job governing the country and wasn't inclusive and many, many issues, but it certainly doesn't, I mean, I criticize the coup, but I just don't think this is the right response. These are millions of members of the Muslim Brotherhood. I think this crackdown just radicalizes them. You know, if they were planning an Islamic revolution and takeover, I guess I would have wanted to see more proof of it. And I just think this is increasing the polarization and won't solve the problem.
Well, it seems to me there's an element of a self-fulfilling prophecy here on the part of those in the West who always argue that the Islamists believe in one vote, one man, one time. And if they enter the political process, once they win, it becomes Sharia law and forget about democracy. So how much is that a factor here that that they're creating their own nemesis?
I don't know. I mean, I should give you a more decisive answer. I think they are creating their own nemesis. I think they've overreacted, and now, you know, it's this whole problem of, you know, looking at the political spectrum in the Islamic world, and, you know, is anyone who's an Islamist, and when I say Islamist, someone who's sort of religious and wants to see Islam as one of the guiding principles in their society, you know, are they the equivalent of Al-Qaeda militants? And, you know, my sense is no. You know, and I think that you don't have that. That's my sense, but clearly members of the secular elite in Egypt flatly disagree with that, think you can't trust anyone who's religious. And, you know, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then you have, you know, Saudi Arabia, Israeli officials, and this sort of basic line that it's the army or anarchy. And I'm just not sure we can return to military rule. You know, I think we're very, you know, we're moving towards civil war, and it really could be this could be seen as this pivotal and really disastrous turn just this last week or two.
So given that you were kidnapped and a prisoner of the Taliban for some time, I take it that you had a real sort of close up and personal experience with radical Islam and those that practice it. And is this a part of our problem, you know, that it goes back to George W. Bush's response to 9/11, where he declared a war on terror, used the word jihadi, which is in many ways a noble term, didn't refer to Al-Qaeda and bin Laden as gangsters or murderers or criminals, but in effect dignified them. And in general, the feeling that I get is that we alienate those very people in Islam who could help moderate those within Islam that take a more radical path. I mean, no Christian or Jew can tell a young Islamist not to take the radical path, surely.
That's the big issue. And again, is the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt the people that could do that? That, you know, again, they've renounced violence since the 1980s. The Ennahda Party in Tunisia, Prime Minister Erdogan in Turkey. And clearly these are hugely flawed movements. Erdogan's response to the Taksim Square protests were terrible. But I was recently, last week, with a Turkish official at an event, and you know, they were just devastated by the scale of the bloodletting, devastated by the American response. And they did say that this is, you know, we are the ones who are trying to convince young men that democracy and the ballot box is the way to go, not jihad. And this, the way this is being handled in Egypt is just an enormous setback for them. A Reuters colleague of mine, Mira McDonald, has written a piece. There's already, there's a Kenyan offshoot of Somalia's, of the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Somalia, Al-Shabaab. And they tweeted, and as events are happening in Egypt, if ever there's a ripe moment to support Al-Qaeda, it's surely now. And it's a piece that my colleague, again, had written from London, saying that this is this, it's almost that the Egyptian crackdown is giving Al-Qaeda a new lease on life. And it's essentially saying, you know, that democracy, we believe in the West in democracy, except for when Islamists win. And then, you know, it doesn't count. And but there's basically chatter online showing that already jihadists are using events there as a recruiting tool.
Well, it does seem extraordinary to when you look back at President Obama's famous speech in Cairo some years back, which was widely regarded as one of the most intelligent and nuanced Western understanding of Islam and the need for to embrace and nurture political Islam. And the only criticism came from the political right. And now it seems that Obama is roundly hated by the secular and liberal people, along with the military and their supporters, who honestly, the man on the street apparently believes that those that oppose the Muslim Brotherhood, they believe that, that Obama foisted the Muslim Brotherhood on Egypt. So obviously, to be an American is about the worst thing you can be now in terms of influencing Egypt. But when you look at the comparison that you make in your article, A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre, David Rode, where you talk about if this is the largest massacre protest since 1989 assault on Tiananmen Square, I recall at the time that the official government response from George H.W. Bush was somewhat similar to what Obama's response has been to this, and that is the kind of realpolitik American political establishment doesn't want to cut ties with the government and basically is trying to sort of, you know, take the path of least resistance.
It is, and you see this in sort of in Democrat and Republican administrations that they, you know, stability. It's all about stability. And with Obama, I think you've seen a tendency to sort of split the difference. You saw that, you know, initially he wasn't really backing the protesters that were trying to oust Mubarak. Then he sort of turned against Mubarak. And it's led to what you described exactly, where opponents, you know, secular opponents of the Muslim Brotherhood are convinced that Obama supports the Muslim Brotherhood. And at the same time, you know, Muslim Brotherhood members are convinced that Obama is supporting the coup. I don't think the U.S. can control, you know, events in Egypt, but I call it idealistic, but I just, it's such a large number of people. It is one of the largest killings of protesters since Tiananmen Square. And, you know, I heard this myself when I was a prisoner with the jihadis. They look for hypocrisy. They look for examples of the U.S., you know, trying to protect American, European, or Israeli lives and not really being so focused on the death of Arabs or Muslims. And they will see this as another example of Western hypocrisy. They will use it as a recruiting tool. And, you know, we sort of, it was an amazing speech in Cairo. There was very little follow-up to that. And you know, we sort of, as I said in the story separately, the Bush approach failed in terms of massive invasions. And this Obama approach, which is kind of vague, you know, minimalist sort of drone strikes and surveillance, you know, doesn't seem to be working either in the region. Again, we can't necessarily stop, you know, what's happening in Egypt, but we at least should have some kind of review of our broad principles. And if we're not going to support democracy, we should stop saying that we are. Or we should really cut aid and stand by these, cut aid to Egypt and stand by these democratic principles.
So, David Rode, when you were a prisoner of the Taliban and they were telling you how they see Americans' support for democracy hypocritical when it comes to Islam and Islamists, were you able to make the argument that after all, Bill Clinton intervened in the Balkans to protect the lives of European Muslims?
I did somewhat, and it was a real mix. Some of the guards would, I think, you know, heard that. You have to make that argument, and you have to stand by those principles. And some people, you know, in the Islamic world are going to hear that and believe it. There are other radicals that no matter what you say or what you do are going to be implacably opposed to the United States. So I'm not going to argue that if suddenly the U.S. embraces democracy, we're going to be popular in Egypt or be popular with jihadis. There is a threat. There are people that, you know, pretty much the only way to respond to them is to use force. But we're losing that sort of great middle, that young group of people in the region that I think, you know, want some form of accountable government. They want basic rights, you know, the right of free speech and the right to assembly. And, you know, again, there's some jihadis we're never going to win over no matter what we do. But I'm very concerned about the much larger group of young people that, you know, believe in these ideals and then see us not supporting them.
Well, you say in your article, at Reuters, a feckless response to Egypt's avoidable massacre, David Rode, that from massacres in Cairo to prison breaks across the region, the United States is more hated and less secure. It does seem in many ways that Iraq is the very nightmare scenario, the big lie, one of the many big lies that the Bush-Cheney people put forth to justify the invasion of Iraq was that Saddam Hussein was somehow playing footsie with al-Qaeda and that they had a base in Iraq. Well, now it appears that they do, and that one of the largest prison breaks were a number of senior al-Qaeda people, I think 800 in all, got out. And clearly that's a reality. The Sunni-Shia split seems to be being exacerbated and inflamed by the war in Syria. So it's quite possible that this whole region is going to get unglued and that we appear to be a spent force, having wasted so much in going into Iraq, where we essentially handed Iraq over to Iran and we're getting out of Afghanistan. So, well, let's start with that question. Do you think that we are a spent force in the region?
I think we are. There's no question. And the American public, I mean, in terms of mounting major military interventions, yes, we are a spent force, and there's no way the American public is going to support another big American ground invasion in the Middle East.
So
I don't think that's how we should respond to this, but yes, that's true.
So then the next question is, what could we do, or how much, you know, is it in our interest to intervene? I mean, it seems like what we're doing and what we're not doing in Syria, you know, some people say it's cynical. It's like what Henry Kissinger said about the Iran-Iraq war that went on for 8 years. He said, you know, it's a pity both sides can't lose. Do we have a policy there? Does that explain our fecklessness in Syria?
Well, I think Syria is very difficult. I think there was a window in the beginning when there, you know, the administration could have potentially armed the opposition, but Syria is a mess. I don't think we have a clear, and I don't think that even if we had armed the opposition in Syria, I'm not sure it would have worked. But I don't think there is a clear policy. I think that the administration is too focused on not being the Bush administration. I said this in the story that there's a difference, you know, declaring that you oppose the killing of hundreds of protesters, you know, is not the equivalent of invading Iraq. And I've seen in other press reports that administration officials talk about how we have to be humble and we can't think that we can influence events in the region. We're so passive that I think it's created a vacuum. And who's moved into that vacuum? Saudi Arabia. They're strongly backing the crackdown in Egypt. So is the UAE. And, you know, they also, the Saudis have been active in Syria in the vacuum there. Who have they chosen to arm? Jihadists. I mean, the Saudis have been exporting, you know, a very hardline version of Islam for decades into the region, starting in Afghanistan in the 80s, and that's been a disaster. One of the things we should be reconsidering is our relationship to Saudi Arabia. This is all far-reaching things, but this belief that you are going to, you know, back the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and military rulers, and we can just turn the clock back. I don't believe that will work. I mean, we can have a decade-long brutal civil war in Egypt as we had in Algeria. With the web, the diffuse nature of these different Al Qaeda affiliates, I just think that's a disastrous strategy. And it's not going to be. We can't turn the clock back, and we just need to reassess our whole approach to the region. And no, we shouldn't be invading, but I think we can be distancing ourselves from the Saudis. Showing more basic rights for people who participate in the political process and abide by democratic norms, focusing much more on economic issues in the region. It may be too late, but there are alternatives. It's not simply that you either invade with 100,000 troops or you do nothing. There are other ways you can work diplomatically and economically in the region to try to stabilize it, or at least back more moderate groups and political parties.
So just in closing, David Rode, is it possible, though, that the subtext here is the shift underway for energy independence in the United States based upon exploitation of natural gas and fracking for oil? And the U.S. is about to become the world's biggest supplier of natural gas, surpassing Russia. And when you talk about Saudi Arabia, which is absolutely true, they created the Taliban, they've destabilized Pakistan, and their mosques around the world have spread an extremely xenophobic and somewhat toxic version of Islam. There's no question that they've been duplicitous and we've been incredibly stupid. But at the end of the day, are we heading into an isolationist period? Are the people like Rand Paul going to be heard more and more? And at the end of the day, what are we losing by getting out of the Middle East?
I think we're definitely heading into a more isolationist period. And, we are going to be more energy independent. The problem is, what do we do when there's huge instability in the Middle East and oil prices are going up for China and for Europe? The Chinese economy and the European economy remains, hugely dependent on Middle Eastern oil. I think we should, if we can, and if, I don't want to get into a debate on fracking, but if we can, reduce the world's dependence on oil from the Middle East, that would be great. The U.S. currently gets more oil from Africa than it does from the Middle East. But what if China's economy starts tanking, India's economy, because they depend on Middle Eastern oil? The same thing with Europe. I mean, we live with a globalized economy. We saw what the debt crisis in Europe, caused in the American economy. Slowdowns in China have an enormous impact here. So I just don't think we can pull back from the region and let it implode and think it's not going to impact us. And for better or worse, we live in a deeply interconnected world now economically, and we can't ignore that.
Well, David Rode, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Rode. He's a columnist for Reuters and a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize and a former reporter for The New York Times. He is the co-author of A Rope and a Prayer, which was about his experiences being kidnapped by the Taliban in Afghanistan. And his latest book is Beyond War, Reimagining American Influence in a New Middle East. And his latest article at Reuters is A Feckless Response to Egypt's Avoidable Massacre. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the declassified history of the CIA's super secret Area 51. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who is a senior fellow with the National Security Archives at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. He has taught at the University of Texas and at American University and is the author of a number of books, including The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, America's Space Sentinels, DSP Satellites and National Security, The U.S. Intelligence Community, A Century of Spies, Intelligence in the 20th Century, and America's Secret Eyes in Space, the U.S. Keyhole Spy Satellite Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson.
Thank you.
And I understand that you made the Freedom of Information request to get these files declassified on Area 51. Were you surprised at what you got? Or did you get more than you expected, less than you expected?
Well, actually, more than I expected. I had filed this request in 2005. And there was an earlier version of this document that was released in 2002, and it was very, very heavily redacted. And the version that came through this time had far less in the way of redactions, and it had information not only on Area 51, but British participation in the U-2 program, the Chinese angle and the flights over China, surveillance of its French nuclear test site, and some new information on other aerial reconnaissance programs. So it was substantially more than I would have expected based on what the case had been last time.
And going back to the beginning of why this area was chosen, it's next to the Nevada test site, and this we're talking about the 1950s. I take it that physically it is surrounded by ridges and it's in a deep valley. It's a dry salt lake, a groom lake. And so what led to the decision and how did it get such a mystique?
Well, what led to the decision was the need to find a place where the U-2 spy plane could be tested in secret. Such a plane had been proposed to President Eisenhower late in 1954 and approved because they were Eisenhower and others were very anxious to find some means of actually penetrating the veil of Soviet secrecy and finding out what was going on at bomber bases and possible missile facilities and naval facilities and atomic weapons related facilities in the Soviet Union, and obviously you couldn't tell simply from flying along the periphery. So they eventually approved the U-2, the program for develop a U-2, and they needed some place to test it, and they wanted some place to test it in deep secrecy because they obviously didn't want the Soviet Union to know anything about this plane. They were hoping it would fly over without even being noticed. And so this was a location that was located by Richard Bissell flying in the area and was selected as some place where they could have this secret facility.
And how do they get people in and out of there? I mean, it's in the middle of nowhere.
Right. Well, they have air service. I mean, mm-hmm. You could go, today they will have people going to the airport in Las Vegas and they go on a plane and they land there, and then they reverse the process to go home.
So they commute to work by an air shuttle.
Yes. It's a remote location, and it's not some place where people are going to be driving to work.
And subsequent to the U-2 program, they tested and developed stealth aircraft there, didn't they?
This is a whole variety. The successor to the U-2, which was known as the Ox Carter, the A-12, was tested there, as was the Air Force variant of the A-12, which is the much better-known SR-71 Blackbird. And in addition to that, later on, the F-117 stealth fighter was tested there, as well as a very sort of strange-looking airplane that never actually became operational, known as Tacit Blue, was also tested in the area. In addition to that,
MiG fighters that were obtained by one means or another that were flown there to allow the U.S. both to understand them better for intelligence purposes and to test them in combat situations.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Archives at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. And he made the Freedom of Information request to find out about Area 51 and has received the first declassified material with any real substance to it. Of course, I guess inquiring minds want to know about the hangar that has the aliens and the alien spacecraft.
Well, that's not in this history. There's the only discussion related to UFOs or anything like that is in this history is about how U2 operations led to at least some of the UFO sightings, but you were flying an airplane at much higher levels than people expected, and so it was something that was quite unusual in the sky, and it was an unidentified flying object in the sense that it was flying and people didn't know what it was, so therefore it was unidentified. But if people are going to look for even oblique clues to anything concerning aliens or crash flying saucers in this history, they won't find it.
Because I recall interviewing a L.A. Times reporter sometime back, Annie Jacobson, who wrote a book, Area 51, An Uncensored History of America's Top Secret Military Base, that talked about some source had said that there was either it was a Soviet-built craft or a real alien. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to fire up the imaginations of people who listen to Art Bell at 3 in the morning. But apparently this mystique, these conspiracy theories have flourished. And so what's your explanation? Is it simply that this is such a secret place that the assumption was that this is where America keeps its most bizarre secrets, whether or not they're true or not?
In a sense, I think you have on the one hand the whole sort of history of this, of the UFO interest and beliefs that there were crash saucers and that we were being visited by people from or beings from other planets. And then you have this incredibly secret facility in a remote part of the country, protected both by the geography as well as very aggressive security arrangements. And so if you believed in crash saucers and aliens, presumably this was the natural place to put them. And so the two things went together. But if you don't believe in the first, then you know there's plenty of reasons to understand what's going on at Area 51 completely apart from aliens.
So it started then as a place to develop the U-2 so that the Soviets didn't know about its existence. Of course, they eventually found out when Francis Gary Powers crashed on May Day in 1960. But prior to that, the plane was incredibly secret. And it started out as a CIA project. Apparently, a personal check was sent to Lockheed to get the thing going from the CIA director, and they developed this program. And my understanding is, I'm trying to figure out here the turf battles that went on between the CIA and the intelligence community and the Air Force, who are also partners in this, because you mentioned the SR-71, the subsequent development of the U-2, which apparently was a very successful, extraordinarily successful airplane. My understanding is that the Air Force just killed that because they got sick of flying this plane, and the take-all went to the CIA. So give us a sense of the turf battles in spite of the fact that they managed to build these very advanced aircraft.
Well, with regard to the U-2, there was a point fairly early on where the Air Force tried to sort of take over the program, and that was resisted. And eventually, you had two programs going on. You had the CIA U-2 effort, which involved actual overflights of denied territory, whether first the Soviet Union and then China and other areas. And you had an Air Force version of the U-2 program where they were doing peripheral flights along borders, doing nuclear sampling. And those two things coexisted until 1974 when the CIA program was shut down. By that time, there certainly were no overflights of the Soviet Union. The overflights over China had ceased, and there was a desire to sort of consolidate the U-2 in one area, and then so it all went to the Air Force. With regard to the Oxcart, that didn't fly, although it was ready to fly years earlier, operationally until 1968. And by that time, there was also a battle between the Air Force and the CIA over the Oxcart versus the SR-71. And they actually had a competition called Nice Girl, in which each of the planes or several missions were conducted from north to south along the Mississippi using the capabilities of each different type of aircraft. And they compared the results, and there was no real conclusive winner. I mean, the Air Force plane had some different sensors than the CIA plane, although they both had optical equipment on board, cameras on board. And eventually it was decided to, after a very bitter battle, to terminate the A-12 program, which happened in 1968, and all those planes were retired and went into hangars, and the Air Force flew the SR-71 then from 1968 till around 1990 when it was retired. There were several attempts to bring it back, but those were pretty futile. And so the SR-71 was then killed by the Air Force, which had gone to such lengths to gain control of that type of program years earlier.
But
And today, the only thing that's sort of left standing or left flying are the U-2s flown by the Air Force.
Which are an earlier version. I mean, they're much older than the SR. Because I understood that at the time that the Air Force canceled the SR-71s, a lot of generals were complaining about not having real-time pictures and stuff. I think it was in the first Iraq War. And they wanted this plane, but it had been canceled by the Air Force for reasons which has never been made clear.
Well, I think that there were, concerns over the amount of resources it took up. I think there was probably just some hostility that it wasn't a plane with any guns on board. It wasn't a shooter. I think there were a multitude of reasons why. And as I said, there were a number of attempts to bring it back over the years for either counter-narcotics missions or other missions, and those never really took hold. And so it finally really did, really was terminated. But, I mean, the U-2s that fly today are much more advanced versions than the U-2s of 1960. They've been through a multitude of generations. And also I think there was anticipation with regard to canceling the SR-71, there would be more advanced drones available. And there were some programs that were canceled in that area that I think people were counting on as replacements.
But still, the predecessor that predated the SR-71 is the one that's still the workhorse.
The U-2, yes.
Yeah. And that's, I must have one of the longest shelf lives of any aircraft. I suppose there was an article the other day about the B-52s, which are still flying since,
right,
what, 1950 or something when they first came on.
Yes. The U-2s are still flying. There have been a number of plans to cancel them over the years. And so far, they're still flying because the proposed successors, whether it's other drones or Global Hawk, have always run into some sort of problem that have prevented them from completely taking over the mission.
And, yeah, with one of them ending up in Iranian hands, which is still a mystery of how that happened.
Right. I think that was the RQ-170 Sentinel
right.
That the Iranians got hold of.
And that still is a complete mystery as to how that happened.
Right.
So, well, just in closing then, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, will this information that you got out of the CIA about Area 51, will it put to rest, do you think, a lot of this speculation about aliens? Because when I tried to talk to the CIA years ago about UFOs and stuff, everybody said, oh, well, that's not our portfolio. That's the Air Force's portfolio.
Right.
I mean, that's been the line all along, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a history that concerns the U2. And so I don't think people who believe that there are crash saucers or dead aliens at Area 51 are going to be I don't think their mind's going to be changed by that, because I don't think they believe that the U2 was just a cover for this stuff and that there was some other reason for maybe establishing the base. They just believe, I presume, that there are part of the bases involved with that activity, and I presume they'll still believe it. I mean, I think the only way you would, you know, put that to rest completely is if you had a complete and thorough history of Area 51, which accounted for everything that ever happened there and everything that was ever built there. And we're a long way from that. So I don't think it's really going to change people's position on that issue.
Well, but given how long it's taken, we're talking about an aircraft developed in the 50s and was flying in until the U-2 Francis Gary Powers was shut down in 1960 on May Day. That's when we first learned about it. So how long is that? That's, what, 50?
3 years.
Yes. So so what are we going to find out about 53 years later about what's going on there now? That's my final question.
Oh, I presume we'll find out about a lot of advanced drones, some of which have been sort of written about but have never officially been declassified, maybe some attempts at other manned aerial reconnaissance planes, some other stealth aircraft experiments. I presume there'll be a lot to find out, but I guess, you know, sort of we don't know what we don't know in terms of some of these aircraft missions or activities. So, but I think that's what we'll find out about is largely aerial projects, whether manned or unmanned, and none of them will be from another world.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dr. Jeffrey Richardson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Jeffrey Richardson, who's a senior fellow with the National Security Archive at George Washington University, where he directs archive documentation projects on U.S.-China relations, the organization and operations of the U.S. intelligence community, U.S. military space activities, and presidential national security directives. He's taught at the University of Texas and at American University, and is the author of a number of books, including The Wizards of Langley, Inside the CIA's Directorate of Science and Technology, America's Space Sentinels, DSP Satellites and National Security, The U.S. Intelligence Community, A Century of Spies, Intelligence in the 20th Century, and America's Secret Eyes in Space, the U.S. Keyhole Spy Satellite Program. His Freedom of Information Act led to the declassification of the latest cache on Area 51. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.